We will, I guess, unofficially call the meeting to order because we don't have a quorum here yet, and as soon as we do, we will call it officially to order. Today, we have House File 2538 in front of us, and Representative Poppe, if you would like to move your bill, you can do that and go ahead and present the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is a bill, this is the Farm to Food Shelf bill, House File 2538. We'll have testifiers to describe it and to give you some information. I think almost everyone around the table is probably aware of what the bill does, but I will briefly introduce it and then turn it over to the testifiers. This is a really feel-good bill, and it should be a do-good bill because we are going to allow farmers who might ordinarily not have a place to put their produce to now have an entity that will be able to gather up that produce and be able to spread it throughout the state, and that's a really good thing. This does bring millions of pounds of fresh Minnesota-grown fruits and vegetables to food shelves across the state. This bill is good for farmers, it's good for rural economies, it's good for urban dwellers, and for the families and seniors in Minnesota who must use food shelves to make ends meet each month. As we know, our economy is getting better. For many of us, we have noticed that, but for some yet in Minnesota, they are finding that recovery is coming a little bit more slowly, and they have a need to go to food shelves. So this is an opportunity for us to, again, have a win-win-win with farmers, with Second Harvest Heartland, with food shelves, and with families. So everybody is going to benefit from this, and I'm very excited and very pleased to be able to be here today with this bill, House File 2538, and I'm going to turn it over first, I think, to Greta to be able to start the introductions.
All right, very well. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Greta Gothier, and I'm with Second Harvest Heartland. We are a food bank based in St. Paul, Minnesota, and we are one of five major food banks serving the state of Minnesota. Today, I'd like to take a minute and introduce our CEO from Second Harvest Heartland, who is here with me, Rob Zeske, and he and I will walk you through the PowerPoint. Everyone should have gotten a handout with the PowerPoint slides on it. And so I will just, we will just get started. And there we go. So I've spoken with many of you in your offices, and thank you for that opportunity. This bill is about food insecurity. The USDA defines food insecurity as a lack of access to the food that you need or your family needs in order to thrive and be healthy. 11.4% of Minnesota families are food insecure, of Minnesotans, excuse me. About 9% of our seniors are food insecure, and about 16.6% of children in Minnesota are food insecure. So what does that mean, food insecure? It means that you may not know where your next meal is coming from on any given day. It may mean that you are skipping meals in order to make sure the food you have lasts through the month. And it may mean that you are, in other ways, trying to figure out how to make ends meet so that you can provide food. And sometimes those choices are very difficult, like seniors choosing between food and medicine, or families choosing between food and heating their homes. We estimate that Minnesota families are missing 100 million meals a year. That's about 10 meals a month for every person. It's costing over $1.5 billion to our state in avoidable health care costs and avoidable remedial education and other services for children who don't do as well when they're not eating right. And also productivity for the adults who are working and the cost of charities like ours. We've seen a 70% increase in senior visits to food shelves in Minnesota since 2008. And this is going to be an area of increasing growth as the baby boom generation ages. I'm going to turn it over now to our CEO to talk a little bit more about the 100 million missing meals, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you very much. I believe that we now have a quorum, so I will officially call the meeting to order, and I want to just tell everybody that I believe we are being recorded or taped today, so be on your best behavior. So, all right. Thank you, Mr. Zeske. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Rob Zeske. I'm CEO of Second Harvest Heartland. Thank you so much for hearing us today. As Greta said, we're facing in Minnesota a gap of missing meals of nearly 100 million every year, and this is according to some research we conducted with the University of Minnesota's Food Industry Center that took a look at not only how much but where these meals were being missed. And so, in essence, we as a state need roughly 100 million meals to fully have every Minnesotan, man, woman, and child have access to these meals. The cost of this, based on the USDA expectations for a thrifty food plan, are about $250 million needed to make sure that we can fill that gap. But perhaps most importantly, if we look at where those missed meals are occurring, we see they're in every part of the state. About 50% of them happen here in the Twin Cities urban and suburban areas, but there's an equal split with the greater Minnesota cities as well as rural communities. And so we find that as we think about a bill like this, we will be benefiting every part of the state that we serve that is in need of additional meals.
So, Mr. Chairman, continuing on, this heat map shows you each county in Minnesota, the amount of missing meals. The darker color counties are the ones with the most missing meals. And you'll see that there are missing meals in every county in the state, and it varies by county. 1 in 10 Minnesotans live at risk of hunger. Interestingly, 39% of the people that come to food shelves are in families where someone, at least one person, is working. So a big part of the issue right now is working families. So when I've met with each of you in your districts, I've looked at every single one of your districts because we have this food insecurity data by census tract. And I took the liberty of choosing a couple of you today to highlight Representative Crecia's district and Representative Clark Johnson's district. This is Representative Crecia's district. You'll see there's almost 4,500 food insecure people there, and they're missing 900,000 meals a year in his legislative district. This gives you a spread of some of the rates by census tract. Remember, the statewide average is 11.4, so in most of the districts, there are some census tracts where food insecurity is below the average of the state, others where it's above. Representative Crecia has a couple that are pretty significantly above. Almost double. Oops, I went the wrong way. So looking at income and unemployment, numbers in Representative Crecia's district, you can see again that sometimes the food insecurity lines up with the income of families where they're making below the federal poverty line or even 200% of the federal poverty. Those tend to be the areas that line up with food insecurity. When we look at the demographics in his district, you can see that there are several tracts there where there's a significant population of seniors. We see that a lot in parts of rural Minnesota. Sometimes folks, especially in the older senior generation who lived through the Depression and World War II, they are adamant against taking any assistance, and that is problematic in terms of finding creative ways to reach out to them. And so I also put up here, just for some variety, Representative Clark Johnson's district, and he and I have not yet been able to sit down, but I will come and meet with you, Representative Johnson. He has almost 5,000 people food insecure in his district as well, and a little over 1 million missing meals a year. His district shows something interesting that can happen also, and that is that when there is a school, such as in St. Peter, there's Gustavus, etc. Sometimes there'll be a tract of college student population there that will elevate the food insecurity. But just because those kids are in college and maybe living off campus, it doesn't mean they can't be insecure with it. Food insecure, you know, they may not be getting enough food and nutrition. So this shows you areas in his district where people are living under the poverty line or under 200% of the federal poverty line. And some demographic, you'll see there we've included the enrolled in college, and the area down there by St. Peter does have 28% of the population is enrolled in college. But again, if those kids are living off campus, they still might. They may not be eating 3 square meals a day. We like to say that hunger is Minnesota's biggest solvable problem because we have the food we need. Because farmers need to meet their contractual amounts, they do plant extra every year. No one knows what the weather is going to be. And so, according to the USDA, every year we have at least 210 million pounds of vegetables and fruits in Minnesota that either are not harvested or are harvested but not sold. We feel that if this food could be moved from the waste stream into the hunger relief food stream, that would really benefit a lot of our families and seniors and others who are in need. So our bill, and you have the language before you, House File 2538, is a $1.5 million appropriation from the general fund. The Department of Agriculture would act as the fiscal agent. On this slide, you can see a list of the crops, and these are all crops that we have already had experience with. As I've told many of you, but I haven't said yet in this testimony, for the past 2 years, Second Harvest Heartland has been doing this very thing that is outlined in the bill. We have had private funding to do a proof of concept for 2 years and show that this can be done. We currently have a network of 94 farm operations in 36 counties. There is a handout in your packet that shows the counties and numbers of farmers that are participating now. And this list on this slide here, potatoes, tomatoes, sweet corn, five different kinds of beans, including green beans, apples, cabbage, cucumbers, squashes, watermelons, etc. These are things that we already have relationships with those farmers, and so we would be able to go ahead and move those right away once the harvest season is over. The funding from the general fund appropriation would go to reimburse farmers for their cost of getting this donated food out of the field. Getting it out of the field and into some kind of container that we can move in our vehicles. And when I say we, I mean Second Harvest Heartland and our sister food banks in Minnesota. All of the food banks together have been working for 2 years to prove that this can work. I'm happy to say we've done a lot of work and we've gotten the logistics down. For example, for sweet corn, from the time of harvest until arrival at the food shelf is down to 8 hours. We have done that with great cooperation from a number of partners. You'll see in the picture here on the bottom left, that's our sweet corn harvest from last year. As soon as the corn is harvested, it's driven straight to a concrete slab that we are using courtesy of the Cargill folks. And we have developed a unique cooling technique, working with lots of partners, including the Department of Agriculture. We always adhere to food safety standards so that we can cool that corn enough so that when we ship it into our trucks, it will not rot, but go past, you know, be too ripe, over-ripen. There you go. So we are thrilled at how much food we have been able to move. The first year, we moved around 4 million pounds. The second year, a little over 8 million. We've moved about 12 million pounds of fruit and vegetables these 2 years. We're pretty confident that for $1.5 million, we'll be able to move 10 million pounds of food, fruits and vegetables. And if you had to pay for those retail, Mr. Chairman, it would probably cost the state about $20 million. So this slide just talks more about that, and also you may ask, what is Second Harvest contributing to this? Well, we and the other food banks will all contribute in kind, our truck drivers, our trucks, gas, insurance, logistics, the crates, the warehouse equipment. We know how to move food, and once it can get into a container that we can move, we'll take over and get it to food shelves and other meal plans across the state. If you flip that handout over on the back, we show where the food would go. And so the white circle is food shelves, and the red circle are other meal programs. So other meal programs could be a senior congregate dining center, could be a soup kitchen, could be a loaves and fishes site, that kind of thing. Sometimes we deliver to food shelves, and those food shelves may have multiple sites in a county. So it's there's kind of a mix of different things out there, but you can see that food would go to every county in the state. Not only will this provide a better food diversity at our food shelves, it'll be a better nutritional quality of food that people can get, and that will help children do better in school. It will enhance worker productivity. There will be less waste in the food system in Minnesota. We know that farmers, we will pay them this small amount for removing the food from their cost of removing it from the fields and packing it. And we know that they will spend that money back into their local economy, and it will have a statewide impact in terms of where the food would go. We are fortunate to have a number of supporters of this bill, including the Farmers Union, the Farm Bureau, Minnesota Agri-Growth Council, Partners to End Hunger, the Department of Agriculture, and as I said, our sister food banks in Rochester, Crookston, Duluth, and Grand Rapids. And with that, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Zeski and I, and we have some other folks here too, if anyone has questions, we'd be happy to take those. Thank
very
you,
good.
Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You very much. Any questions? Representative Krishan.
Thank you, Chair Faust, and thank you, Representative Poppy, and thank you for bringing this up. It's never fun when you have to look directly at the quantitative statistics of your district, especially when you know where they're slanted. And I thank you very much, Ms. Gauthier, for bringing that to my office. It was great. I was aware of most of it, but quantitatively it made a lot of sense. I don't think you'll have any problem with this bill, especially when you look at all the signers. But this is an important one, and I wish all the bills that we had in front of us had this much homework behind it and this much goodwill. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Preshaw. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I echo those sentiments that this sounds like a win-win-win. Just a question. We did talk a bit about your logistics situation. It's amazing you can get products as quickly as you can from field to wherever they're going to go. In the first 2 years, were there ever any quality issues, or have you got this down to a system where you can expand like you're thinking about and still maintain that quality?
Yeah, thank you for the question. During the first 2 years, I think that's exactly what we did. Our first year, we did have some concerns with particularly with the sweet corn. That was the only product we really had major issues with, and that was what led to the second year's cooling work. And so we're going to continue to expand that. But from a quality standpoint, unlike much of the work that we traditionally have, which is second run product, often this is first run product. This is just hasn't been able to be harvested for whatever reason. So in many ways, this is preferable to some of the other things that we've been able to get. So we feel very good about our ability to capture and move that. Safety is always our first priority, but making sure the quality is there too.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yeah, Representative Bouguinis.
Not a question so much as a comment, because I am one of the authors of this bill and really appreciate it. I note on here there are only two fruits, and I wonder if you see in the future opportunities for other, this is for this bill and that's fine, but looking ahead, do you see opportunities for other fruits, and what might they be?
Mr. Zeski.
Yeah, I think we'd be very open. I think this is certainly the starting list where these are products with which we have worked before, and so we are very interested in expanding that list to other valuable fruits and vegetables. So I may turn it over to my counterpart to address which particular fruits might be available. We are usually drawn, and I think it's easiest for us to work with some of those vegetables and fruits that have longer shelf lives. So apples, apples are easier, and potatoes are sometimes easier than our peas, for example. So that weighs into this, but I think we are just beginning after 2 years to learn more about how we can work with a variety of growers, and this bill will enhance our ability to reach additional products.
Okay. Any other questions? No? All right, then we can bring the next testifier up, Gary Paul, I believe it is. And thank you both for your testimony. Well, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gary Paul from Paul Farms. We're in Apple Valley, Minnesota. And our relationship with Second Harvest originally started 3 years ago. We had due to the weather situations, we farm about 1,000 acres of different types of vegetables, all fresh market. And in the process of farming vegetables for fresh market, you're at the mercy of the weather, be it, you know, the rain, temperatures, that type of thing. Well, this particular year, everything bunched up due to like 3 weeks of 90 degree weather. And we were sitting around, and a friend of mine says, well, have you ever contacted the food shelf? So I got in contact with Tony Manns of Second Harvest. I says, you know, I'd like to move, got a couple semi-loads of sweet corn that we possibly could move, and you know, if you can line something up. Within about 3 to 4 hours, he says we could probably use 4 to 5 semi-loads, you know, not in only in our area, but also in other parts of the country. And that relationship started with sweet corn, and now is encompassing on a weekly basis. We ship them cabbage, green beans, sweet corn, cucumbers, and peppers. The last 2 years, we've set up a schedule where Second Harvest, we go into Second Harvest twice a week. And last year alone, we donated 847,000 pounds of, which is equivalent of like say four or, you know, approximately 40 semi-loads. Mm-hmm. So our 28 semi-loads, whatever. But if you guys have ever been up to Second Harvest, because when this all took place, I go, there's no way any, you know, food shelf can handle this type of volume. And I visited Tony's complex up there in Maplewood, and it was just unbelievable how they unloaded trucks, sorted things, moved it out to their, you know, the second tier drivers, and the trucks were basically on the road by the time your produce was getting unloaded. It was getting loaded up and slotted for, you know, someplace, you know, another food shelf, you know, around the state. And I went back to our employees, because everybody was concerned, you know, what are you going to do with all this extra food that basically we worked our rear ends off for the last 3 months to produce? And it was going to go to waste. You know, Cub Foods, Target, Walmart, we sell to all of them. I mean, their demand is only, you know, so much. They can only handle, and being that it's such a perishable product, you know, their demand during those types of weeks, they can only handle so much. What are we going to do with it? Tony's crew came in and basically laid out the groundwork for everything, for all our products. So in the last 2 years, you know, it's been on an orderly fashion where they knew product was coming in, they could send it out to their other food shelves, and it's been a great partnership for not only us, but them as well. And you ask about fruits and, you know, the fruits that could be provided. Our biggest cost when it comes down to production is our harvest costs. And the easiest thing to do is put a disc to it. You know, if you're going to have extra product, you're going to, you know, you can't move it, well, it costs you a lot of money, you know, as far as you start breaking down all your harvest costs. You know, so I think a bill like this would help alleviate some of those pressures and enable Second Harvest to go to other growers outstate, you know, the smaller berry growers, you know, different types of crops that, you know, the Wadenas and, you know, the Alexandrias, because all those growers have extra product too. But for a grower itself to, you know, to, you know, donate that much labor and time and packaging, because right now we're USDA Food Gap certified, you know, and 95% of the growers that provide Second Harvest, you know, product are also GAP certified or harmonized GAP certified. So everybody's on the same page here. But the cost of getting that fruit off the vine into their facility is where there's a, you know, a big need to finish. And if something like this is provided, it would provide more incentive for the growers to, you know, go that extra step. And the reason why I kept going with this program and looked at it the second year was when we were packing the truck, this is the first year, you know, full of sweet corn, it was headed for out of state. But our employees were so proud, you know, that we weren't going to let this stuff go to waste. and put it into somebody's hands that needed it. And that's what made it so rewarding for me as a grower, and to help something, provide a product that people in need in this country. We're the world's richest country in the richest country in the world. There's no reason why we can't let something like this, why we would let something like this go to waste when we could be putting it in hands of people that really need it. So,
very good, Chairman. Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Paul? No? All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thanks for
and for your contribution, for your donation of all of the fruits and vegetables. We appreciate that. Thank you.
It's been our pleasure.
Next testifier is Jennifer Woodford. Welcome to the committee, and thank you for joining us. Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Woodford. I'm the Executive Director of Channel 1 Regional Food Bank, which serves 13 counties in southeast Minnesota. The numbers that we see on a daily basis are staggering. We know that nearly 10 million meals are missing in our service area each year. And it would take over $25 million to close the food gap just in our region. Each month, 3,700 families visit the Channel 1 Supplemental Food Shelf. And by working in partnership with other hunger relief agencies, we will distribute 10 million pounds of food to over 100,000 people struggling with hunger this year. 100,000, 10 million, 3,700, 25 million. These are the staggering numbers that our food bank alone works with every day. The people that we help feed face staggering numbers of their own. $4 for 3 pounds of apples, $2 for one squash, or $3 for a bundle of fresh spinach. With those same numbers, a person on an extremely limited food budget could buy one can of tuna and a box of tuna helper, or 1 pound of pasta and one can of spaghetti sauce for a complete meal, or they could even buy 1 pound of processed lunch meat and one loaf of white bread, which would provide them several lunches. Each day, we hear from people who deal with their own staggering numbers. Those people struggle, sometimes to the point of tears, as they work on a shopping list for their family. Because due to the staggering numbers that are in front of them, they know they can't afford the fresh apples or squash or spinach that they want to feed their families. Instead, they will buy the canned tuna, pasta, or other processed foods that they can stretch further with their small food budgets. In 2010, Channel 1 was able to distribute only around 1 million pounds of fresh produce. But over the past several years, we've been an active part of the agricultural surplus pilot program with our fellow food banks in Minnesota. And thanks to grant funds received and other efforts, in 2013, we were able to significantly increase the amount of fresh produce that we were able to secure and distribute, with a total of over 2 million pounds now going out in fresh produce. We know that hunger hurts. It hurts families trying to feed themselves on a single income. It hurts the health and well-being of our senior population. And it hurts the educational opportunities for kids who don't have enough to eat. We can and will continue to provide food to those who are hurting. But we also know that what we feed people is extremely important. Olmsted County has just released its top 5 community health priorities as determined by the Community Health Needs Assessment that was conducted jointly by Mayo Clinic, Olmsted Medical Center, and Olmsted County Public Health. 2 of the top 5 needs identified, obesity and diabetes, are directly linked to what people eat. Funds granted to farmers in the Farm to Food Shelf program would provide an additional 1 million pounds of agricultural surplus to help feed people struggling with hunger in southeast Minnesota each year. 1 million pounds of fresh potatoes, sweet corn, tomatoes, carrots, apples, and so many other crops that will feed people what they need to thrive each day. I brought with me a voice today in the form of this paper plate, and I know it'll be hard for you to see. But this paper plate was drawn by one of our clients, a little girl named Jenna. And the paper plate says, "Hunger feels like you are starving for food, and we need people to help." And she drew a picture of herself, and it's hard to see, but she's got a tear on her face. On behalf of Jenna and the 100,000 people in Southeast Minnesota that we help feed each day and who need your help, thank you for your consideration of this important legislation.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Woodward. Do we have any questions? No? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate that.
Representative Post?
Yes. Sorry. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the population that you feed. Do you have any idea what percentage of those folks are, there's an income in that family, that they're working families?
As Greta mentioned, you know, the largest population of individuals that we feed in our food shelves and through other feeding programs are households that are working. We have about 60% of our households through our food shelf that we serve that have at least one income. But many times it's one income, or they're not able to get enough hours to fully be able to feed their family. They've had their hours cut. We've seen a lot of underemployment in our area and in the people that we serve. But the majority do have some income and are working.
Yeah, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, do you have any idea how many of those folks are making less than $9.50 an hour?
I don't have that exact data. We can work and find out that if you would like.
Thank you very much. All right. Any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Go ahead.
Thanks. I don't mean to hog the microphone or anything.
Sorry, I was looking this way first.
Thank you, ma'am, for your testimony. Talk for a little bit about your relationship with Second Harvest. I live out in northwestern part of the state and want to see this great program all over the state. So how do you work together with them to get it to your area, and how does it get to the rest of the state as well?
Ms. Yeah. Woodford.
We all the food banks work together. We formed a cluster. We share, we communicate, we cooperate. Second Harvest Heartland, being in the cities and having wonderful access to a lot of produce and transportation, leading the charge in terms of with a lot of the farmers, but we all work together. We all play our roles with the growers in our area, again, communicating, cooperating, and distributing as much as we can really throughout the state.
Okay. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you for the great work that you're doing, for all of you, the last testifier as well. The amount of the children, though, are there? Do you have numbers of children that you're feeding?
About
40%. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. About 40% of the people, of the individuals that we are serving, are children.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? No, thank you very much for your testimony, and we would ask Tom Peterson to please come forward for his testimony. And please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and I'll be very brief. We do support this legislation, and worked on this idea. I was thinking about this when Ms. Gothier approached me about this bill. This is an idea that actually the Ag Committee had several years ago, because there was a representative on here, Representative Ron Szymanski, and he sold apples at the Minneapolis Farmers Market. We got in a discussion in the Ag Committee about what happens to leftover food from the farmers markets, and that led to one thing and another, and it led to a task force, which a lot of times things do. And a lot of times I end up on those task forces, and I'm always glad to do it. But the one was a Feeding Minnesota task force, and I actually got up early this morning and went and looked at that again, which is another thing. A lot of times we do these task force reports, and you guys all get them, and then we never read them again. But I encourage you to look at that. And I couldn't get my printer to work, and then it was 47 pages long, but it has a summary. But it's a Feeding Minnesota task force, and it looked at all of the different ideas about how do we get excess food from not just farmers markets, but fields and other food companies to food shelves and people who need the food. And one of the recommendations was this idea of developing a program that could help reimburse producers for the procurement of surplus products. The one thing we did in there too is we developed a comprehensive survey of producers to see is this a good idea? Is this something you would do? Would you take your extra surplus, or what's the barriers? And I was looking at it this morning, and it was interesting, and I remember this very clearly, that 51%, I think we had 200 producers right back in the survey, but 51% said they didn't have the time to donate the food, which I thought was interesting, and I think so an incentive would help that. And 36%, it was the other high one, was labor cost and your money and time and everything associated with doing it. And so that is my encouragement for your to pass the bill. But if you get a chance, take a look at it, because there's a lot of good ideas in there. Thank you.
All right. Any questions for Mr. Peterson? No? All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Peterson, for your testimony. And the last one I have on the list, Jason Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, state your name, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. My name is Jason Reed. I'm with Hunger Free Minnesota. So, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. On behalf of Hunger Free Minnesota, which is a statewide campaign to add 100 million meals to our hunger relief system by 2015, we're proud to offer our support for the Farm to Food Shelf legislation you have before you today, which expands upon a two-year pilot program to add millions of pounds of fresh farm produce for Minnesotans in need. As you've heard from Mr. Zeski and Ms. Gauthier, Minnesotans are missing 100 million meals every year. And as the hunger need has continued to rise over the last few years, the amount of food donated to food banks and food shelves from traditional sources, which often are from food manufacturing companies, from processors, etc., they've been declining, in part because these traditional sources have more efficiency in their supply chains than they had before. So with these traditional sources of food declining, our hunger relief system is now adapting to this challenge. So a 2011 Feeding America study showed that fresh produce, particularly surplus from farms, is the biggest potential source of growth for food for the hunger relief system, both in Minnesota and nationally. So this program is very important, and we have been proud to found a statewide working group that's been working over the past 2 years with partners such as Second Harvest Heartland, Cargill, General Mills, the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the AgriGrowth Council, the law firm Dorsey & Whitney, an advertising agency called Cole McBoy, Channel One, obviously you've heard from today, Great Plains Food Bank, and the Emergency Food Shelf Network, to build and advise on these pilot approaches to acquire surplus agricultural food across Minnesota farms in 2012 and 2013. So it's been very successful. We're very excited about the results. And this program is about Minnesotans helping our own. It's about Minnesotans helping Minnesotans. So sort of utilizing our own nutritious food that's already being grown in this state and redistributing this surplus to Minnesotans in need. So we think you have an important opportunity here to add more healthy food to our hunger relief system. And we urge your support of this critical legislation. So thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Reed? If not, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on the bill that has not had the opportunity to? No. Quiet bunch today. Oh, they're waiting for my presentation. That's what that's what it's all about. Yeah, okay. All right, well, I would take this opportunity then to thank Representative Poppy for bringing this forward, and as well as all of the other people. I don't know whose idea it was. My father, who is now 80 years old, plants 6 acres of squash every year and donates all of the squash to the North Dakota Food Bank, or Food Shelf, whatever they call it there. And as he was starting this process 5 or 6 years ago, the bottleneck was always the harvest. How do you get the harvest? And he finally got a class from the college in town to come out and pick it all for him. And so, I mean, you guys are, you know, you're hitting the nail on the head here, in that this is the bottleneck. This is the problem, and you're doing what needs to be done to fix that. And so thank you for bringing it forward, and a great idea. And with that, Representative Poppy, do you have any closing comments?
Just once again, this is a win-win-win, and it's from farm to food shelf to families, and I really appreciate all of the co-signers on the bill. And if you haven't co-signed, certainly please consider doing that, because it's, you know, it's great for all of us.
Very good. And I guess Representative Anderson wanted to.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. One final question. Realizing this is not the Finance Committee, just a quick question on the $1.5 million. Is it going to be baseline funding going on out of the Department of Ag's budget, or how is the continuing funding going to be handled?
Representative Poppe.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. Yes, it will be appropriated from the general fund, from the Commissioner of Ag, so it will be from that department budget. So that will be increased so that we'll be able to do this, and we will be going next to the Finance Committee. So we will hopefully get the approval there and then be able to see the bill move on.
Okay. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chair. I am also a co-signer on the bill, and I think it's a great bill. It's an opportunity for us to really deal with the food insecurities. And as a church administrator, we work with Channel One and many others around, and it really is essential that we are able to get some, especially in this case, it's excess food that would just go to waste, to get to people that can use it. Mine was kind of a follow-up question from Representative Anderson, and that is just, what is the thought about future years beyond this, and will this be sufficient to continue this on forward?
So. Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Petersburg. I think this is a great start. It may or may not take care of the 100 million missing meals per year, but I think this is going to be a great opportunity. And as was reported earlier, there will be a continued effort to try to have partners, private partners, who will be able to supplement the amount so that the access can continue, and everybody can work together.
Very good. Any other questions? If not, any last comments, or do you want
to? I'd just like to move the bill from this committee to the Environment, Natural Resources, Ag, Finance Committee.
Okay. I guess all in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. Thank you very much, and good luck on the rest of the way in the bill. With that, I guess we have Representative Clark Johnson's legislative district profile. We're just going to, you know, the anticipation is just going to build a little bit longer, Representative Anderson. So, Representative Johnson, you're free to proceed whenever you're ready there.
Can I just present from here, or do I ask you?
I think you can.
I'm a high school teacher, so this is...
Okay, talk loud so that the microphones pick you up.
Maybe I can get my friends here to help me with these packages. And here's a... These are, I recall that last year I saw the presentations, and I remember Representative Norris brought us treats from Otter Tail County, and Representative McGinnis brought us cookies from the Her Food Co-op, and I thought I didn't want the idea of a food co-op to be limited to the metropolitan area, that in St. Peter, Minnesota, one of my favorite towns in this, is a very strong and venerable institution called the St. Peter Food Co-op. And so these cookies, by the way, my wife helped me put these together, so they're a little hard to open up. But anyway, here's some information on the food co-op. And so when I start about agriculture, I start by thinking about eating and food. And the co-op has provided nutritious and delicious foods to our communities in my district for a long time. And it's really an important institution. They recently just expanded with a new facility on Minnesota Avenue. And it's kind of the center of the town in many ways. And they draw customers from throughout Nicollet County and throughout my region. I'm also going to pass on, but anyway, that gets you started. I got some napkins and Eric. I'm sorry to make that so hard for you, but
happy to do it.
There's a treat at the end of this for you. And my wife even had matching. Notice the matching napkins to the food co-op on it.
Oh, thank you.
She takes good care of them. But anyway, grab a cup. But that's really, that just is the tip of the iceberg when we talk about agriculture in my district. My district is all of Nicollet County, and so that's the focus of what I'll be talking about. And that's certainly where most agricultural production is in my county. I also have part of Mankato, and I'll be speaking about that a little bit, and as well as part of the Seward County, mostly around Cassota, and there's less agriculture in that part of the county, so I'll be focusing on Nicollet County and then Mankato. In Nicollet County, does anybody wish it were August right now? Can you picture August in Nicollet County? Well, if this were August in Nicollet County and we were driving around the county, we would see a veritable garden of rich soybeans and corn. And it's just green. It's almost steaming. And as the county gets ready for a harvest, I passed out a summary of the primary large agricultural production in the county. And you can see that, I'd say if I were to summarize it, Nicollet County agriculture focuses on corn, on beans, and hogs, and dairy. Yesterday, at the hearing, you heard me talk a little bit about the Annexed Dairy Farm, and I'll mention that again in a moment. But there's also larger dairies. One of the largest dairies, I would assume, in the state operates just outside of St. Peter. But this is a high-production economy in Nicollet County of those. And so I think you can read the numbers on it. Just trust me, Nicollet County is all about agriculture. Across the river is Mankato, and Mankato is really a city that was able to grow partly due to agricultural processing. And there's three very important mills in the city of Mankato. Two of those are actually in my district, and one of them is across Highway 14, never missing the chance to mention Highway 14 in the legislature, across the Highway 14 from my district. And one of the mills is Honeymead, which was started, it's really kind of the base for Archer Daniels Midland way back in the old days. It's now owned by CHS, Senate Harvest States. And they make soybean oil. And that's on the Minnesota and the Blue Earth Rivers. Also downtown Mankato is the oldest mill in town, and that's currently owned by Cargill. And I was actually an investigator interested to learn that they process wheat flour there. I would have assumed it were not that, but that's an old right downtown mill and dominates the skyline of downtown Mankato. And then the largest mill is Archer Daniels Midland, has a huge soybean mill on the north side of town, and they make feed out of the beans at that mill. Also in my district, that I'm proud to say, are two commodity groups for the state. They have their offices. The soybean growers and the pork producers are located in the city of Mankato, and actually in my district. I don't want to go into all the details of the numbers of the ag production. Just leave it be said that it's a high production area. But what I want to finish with is this concept of the family farm, because it intrigues me. I've been trying to get a handle on what is family farming in Nicollet County, and I tried to get some data, and Eric, thank you for helping me with that. We haven't quite accomplished it. It's a little elusive to get the information. But when you live there, you know it. And you know it because as you talk with folks and you observe the people who live in the countryside, our land is farmed by family farmers. And I perceive a lot of it's brothers working together as the farms have grown. We see families working together, multiple families. And that Annexed Dairy Family, Dairy Farm is an example of that. Two brothers now operate the family farm. But as I mentioned yesterday, I think you've got the two brothers are the core of the operation, but they also work, their three children work on that farm. And as does their mother works on that farm. She pays a lot of attention to the calf. And so it is a family operation. And when I talk about when I talk to farmers in the district, it's not unusual to hear about brothers working together, fathers and sons. And it really are family farms. They're a little different than the family farms that I knew growing up in the Red River Valley of North Dakota, and the family farms that were my cousins that had farms, in that they are larger and they're more production oriented, perhaps, and they're more concentrated on several commodities as opposed to the broader range of both animals and commodities. But really, what you see is it's a family based operation, and There's certain memories I'm getting as a new legislator. I enjoy some moments that you have. And I recall one moment about a year ago when a group of farmers were in my office. And they were from Nicollet County, and one of them happened to mention that this was the year that his family farm was becoming a 150-year farm. And they had been talking to me about all the issues associated with raising corn and beans in Nicollet County and in Minnesota. But it was that glint in his eye, and this is a man about 40 years old, 35 years old, when he said, we're becoming a 150-year family farm. And what that meant to him as a person, as a family member of that. My point being that it's about agriculture, it's about production, it's about food, but it's also about a way of life. And it's clear that way of life continues. And so a lot of what we're doing, whether it's on Highway 14, or if we're supporting biodiesel or whatever we're doing, it's really maintaining that lifestyle and maintaining a key part of our economy in District 19. So that's my summary. Eric Buffer, any questions?
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Are there any questions? All right, thank you. Thank you for the tweets as well. And now it's Representative Faust. Turn to.
I got my computer hooked up here.
What was that highway you talked about?
Because I think, Representative Petersburg, you have an interest as well in Highway 14, do you not?
You should say that every day.
And Representative Fritz, and absolutely. Absolutely.
Who do you bring
in? I'm not sure yet. Maybe you
bring Alan. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just wanted.
Yes. Oh, there.
I just wanted to tell this committee that, for those of you that fell in love with the Barrel of Fun products, yes. I still have some licorice in my office.
Cool.
Stop
very
by.
Good. You might.
It's red. I feel it. Like
you might
red.
Have some visitors. Thank you, Representative Nornes. Representative Faust, you just let us know when you're ready.
I'm ready.
Okay. Go ahead.
I'm going to start in a very interesting place, and at the time you'll probably wonder why, and hopefully by the time I'm done you'll at least have a clue why. But I'm going to tell you a lot of stuff you probably already know, but I'm going to cover it anyway because it helps explain what has happened to agriculture in my district over the last 100 years, and more specifically the last 30 years. So this is a professor of Dr. Jimmy Richardson, an NDSU soil professor, and probably the best professor I ever had when I went to college at NDSU. And so if you've ever wondered what a soil professor looks like, this is it. although, you know, I don't think all soil professors probably look like that, but he was. Now, the reason that I show his picture is because he always talked about the Minnesota Mason-Dixon line. And if you're not familiar with what that term is, and I guess, oh, there, my mouse does work on here. What it is the separation between what was naturally forest lands and naturally grasslands. And Highway 94 follows the Mason-Dixon line almost exactly. Okay, and so most of the land north of that were naturally forest, and most of the land south of that was naturally grassland. Now, I want to point out, and I don't know if you can see it very well or not, but you can see in the northern northeast corner of Minnesota, there's a lot of green there, those forests. Well, there's a gap between the Mason-Dixon line and the line of forests. And what that is there's a gap there where agriculture is actually fairly productive on natural forest land. Once it got to the point where it was so marginal it didn't work very well, it has grown back into forest. And so that's where the green part of the map is. And if you look at my district, which is straight north of the Twin Cities, about halfway up to Duluth, you'll see the green line starts in the northern part of my district. And so my district is part forest and part forest land that is now being farmed. And the reason that some of the forest land has been farmed is that it's been long enough since the last glacier was there that it kind of leveled out itself over time, and it is relatively productive farmland. There are spots north of that, you know, even in probably Representative Dill's district, where, you know, the glacier left some good dirt, and there may be a circle of 2 or 3 miles that people are farming. But generally from there north, it's not very productive farmland other than just spots like that. So next, this is what a typical prairie soil would look like. You can see the nice thick layer of black dirt. The black dirt is black because of the organic matter in the dirt, and the more organic matter, the thicker and the darker that zone of dirt is. Now, what that does is it increases the water-holding capacity of the soil, as well as that organic matter breaks down, it releases nitrogen, which the plants need to grow. And so the native prairie soils are very productive. Well, at least very productive farmland. They store water well. They release the nitrogen as the plants need it, so it's very productive farmland. And fortunately for Minnesota, the majority of the southern part of the state has this soil type and is very productive. North of the Mason-Dixon line, this is what the soil looks like. The forest soil, you can see a very, very thin layer of black dirt. And so there's very little organic matter, and the water storage capacity is not as good. And so the farmland naturally is not as productive as it's going to be south of Highway 94 for the Mason-Dixon line. So the other large piece of soil type that we have in Minnesota is where Lake Agassiz was, which is known today as the Red River Valley. And there the black dirt can be several feet deep. I mean, it is so incredible, and some of the most productive farmland really in the entire world. So my counties are pine and Canavic counties. I have just about all of pine and the majority of Canavic counties, and that's District 11B. And I don't know if you can see my mouse or not, but it's right there. And so, like I said, it's about halfway between Minneapolis and Duluth. And and we have because we are a native forest, and it was formed by the last glacier that went through, we have a very diverse topography. We have several rivers that run through there. We have a lot of forest land. We have some good farmland. We have lakes there. We have all of this stuff. But one of the things that it does is that a lot of my district has resulted in very small fields. I know farm chemical applicator one year, his average size field was 14 acres. Out of all of the 8,000 acres he sprayed that year, his average field was 14 acres. So if you have one 80-acre field, imagine how many 10-acre fields it takes to make your average 14 acres, and how many times he's got to fold up those booms to go from one field to another. And so but the point is, it's very diverse topography, and that has led to very, very small fields. What's the smallest field you've got, Representative Anderson?
Oh, probably 40 acres would be my smallest.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. And what's your biggest? Probably
120.
Yeah. So it because of that, it has dictated what is naturally this area or this part of the state was, and that was dairy farms. In the early when the settlers first came here from mostly northern European countries, not only but mostly from there, they first came here, you know, in 1890, maybe even a little bit earlier, but around that time is when a lot of this area was settled. And what compared to Norway, this farmland was actually really good. They thought this was great. In fact, north of me a ways, there's a town called Goodland, because they thought, this is so good compared to what we're used to. Well, I don't know if there's even any farms within 20 miles of Goodland anymore. But when they came here, a lot of farmers would have, you know, 3 or 4 milk cows, 3 or 4 pigs, a few chickens, and this type of thing. Well, then in the 1920s and 30s, when the REAs came through, all of a sudden, the farmers were able to expand, especially in the dairy area, and they got up to 30, 40 cows. And so if you drive around my district, you see a lot of dairy farms just like these, or a lot of dairy barns just like this. A lot of them have parts missing now because it's been a while since a lot of them have been used. But the point was is that when the REAs came through, all of a sudden the farmer and his kids could farm more than just a couple cows. They could now have 30 or 40, maybe even 50 milk cows.
And because of the small field size and because of how productive the land was, is that that's what worked well there. And so so for 50 years, that was the main thing that was happening in the majority of my district was dairy farms. In 1984, Canaba County, and I don't know what my next, oh, yeah. In 1984, there were 430 dairies in Canaba County. Canaba County is not geographically a real big county, but there are 430 dairy farms in that county. Today, there are 24 farms in Canaba County. And so you, a lot of you remember the dairy buyout. That affected about 100 of those farms, but there's over almost 300 farms that have gone out of business other than through the dairy buyout in the last 30 years. And so you see an awful lot of dairy barns in my district that look like this now. And so the interesting thing, though, is that even though the number of dairy farmers has gone from 430 to 24, the number of cows has fallen approximately in half, but the milk production has stayed almost level. It really hasn't decreased that much. And so even though there's a lot less. So this is a map, and I just want to point out, and it didn't come in very clear, my technology is not, my skills are not very good. This is like the first PowerPoint I think I've ever done in my life. And so I don't know how to draw lines around things and stuff, you know, complicated things, but I can drag and paste pretty easy. So anyway, I want to point out Mora here, which is the county seat of Canaba County. Mora in 1984 had both a Land O'Lakes ice cream plant as well as a Land O'Lakes milk drying plant, and Malacca, 20 miles away to the south west of us, had a milk bottling plant. Those three are all gone today, and in Malacca now, this is the where the bottling plant was. It's an empty lot. In Mora, one of the where the drying plant was is now a 72-unit apartment complex, and where the ice cream plant was is now a nice shiny new bank. And so you know, this has really resulted in a huge change of agriculture in our district. And so some of the things that people, we do have some people that have built newer dairies. We've got a dairy in the southern part of the state that has over 300 dairy cows. There's some in the Pine City area that are that large or larger. And if you look at it, where these larger dairy barns have been built, are where we have the more productive parcels of agriculture, where the fields are not 14 acres, where the average fields are more like 80 or 160 acres. And because with 14-acre fields, you can't farm enough to feed 300 cows, and so you really need larger fields in order to produce the feed you need for that large of a livestock production. So most of the large farms are the ones that have expanded are pretty much in the southern part of my district where the better farmland is. And there are some up north, again, where they ended up with one of those places where it's a mile or two of fairly productive land. But generally, as a rule, the dairy farms that have survived, that are expanding, are in the southern part of the district. So so there's another shot of another fairly modern dairy barn. And so we do have some in our district, but not nearly as many as in Stearns County. And so, you know, this was once the main thing. So today our agriculture has become very diverse. We've got a lot more crop farmers that are growing corn and soybeans and other things. In 1990, the average growing degree days for corn that the farmers planted in our area was 75-day corn. And they quite commonly say, and about half the time we combine it, the rest of the time we have to chop it for silage because that's our only option. Which also led to why there were so many dairies in there, is they had to have a way to use that corn if they couldn't combine it because it froze too early. And so so that was, but because our growing season has gotten longer now and better genetics and all this, we're now planting 100, 105-day corn in our district, and they combine it pretty much every year. And so so this has also led to the decline of dairy in our area. We also have a worm farmer in the northern part of the district. He ships most of his worms to Michigan, but he produces, and he told me one time how many thousands or hundreds of thousands of pounds of worms he produces here, and I'm sorry, I don't remember, but a lot of worms. And so
what are they used for?
One of the interesting things you don't expect to see, you know, in the middle of northern Pine County, but We also, because of the work of the University of Minnesota and the improved winter hardiness of some of the apple lines, we now have some apple orchards in Pine County. Not too long ago, the apples would have had a tough time surviving there, but because of the increased winter hardiness, we now have apple orchards there. We have vegetable stands that pop up all over the place now that probably 20 years ago weren't as prevalent as they are now. And a lot of the dairy farmers who converted their farms over to beef farms. They keep those smaller fields in hay, and they keep the pasture that they've always had in pasture, and so we have a lot more beef farming in our district than what we used to have. We also have people that raise pheasants as hunting preserves and things like that. We also are home to one of the largest egg producers in the state, Lomas Egg Ranch, which is near Finlayson, if you're familiar with where that's at. And so they produce an awful lot of eggs. Most of their eggs go into Wisconsin and northern Michigan. But this is the way it used to be. And, you remember when this time used to be. So, some of you spent time in barns like this. And if you listen close, you can still hear that air compressor running in the background. And that milking machine still pumping that milk. And Boone and Erickson playing on the radio. Actually, I'm just kidding. You can't hear any of that. But we can remember those times. And, those times, whether good or bad, are gone forever. But a lot of us grew up in barns like that. I would go to my cousin's place and be amazed at the milking that was happening there and help them dump the milk in the cream cans like this little boy is doing a few times myself. But I know a lot of you have done a lot more than I have. But this is the way it used to be in our area and a big part of the state. But that has changed. So if I were going to sum up agriculture in my district today, I would say changing. But if I had two words, I'd use changing and diverse, I guess. So changing, diverse, so I guess the two words describe agriculture in my district, diverse and changing, and becoming more diverse as it's changing. So that's it. No cookies, nothing like that, but that's it. So
thank you, Representative.
Actually, Representative Anderson had a question.
Thanks, Representative. That was kind of a walk down memory lane and really interesting and very good. I know you're kind of an expert on soils, and you talked about relatively productive soil, then you showed the profile with not a lot of black dirt. So I was thinking there's got to be irrigation there that really helps increase that production. Then you talk about 14-acre fields. Is there much irrigation? And I would assume that helps make your fields more productive, doesn't it?
Well, it would, but there's very, very little irrigation that goes on there. I know of one person that does some, and that's really it in the whole district. Part of the problem is that the fields are so small and so irregular shaped and so much up and down that they really have a hard time getting an irrigation pivot system to even run. And so there, in my district, there's very, very little irrigation that's happening.
Thank you. And Representative Nornes had a question.
I had to step out for a minute, and I missed some of your presentation anyway. Did you skip over the Hinckley Casino?
I skipped over the Hinckley Casino. Okay.
And I guess I bring that up only because tourism still must be a part of your economy in that part of the state too, isn't it?
It is. You're absolutely right. The Hinckley Casino is the largest employer in my district by four times than the next closest. And interestingly, there was where the Hinckley Casino was built, and some of you have probably been by there, there was a dairy farm along the road between the interstate and the casino. And it was a very productive, well-respected dairy farm in the area. And they sold out to a group of people that built a golf course there. And if you drive by, you can still see the red building that was, I believe, the milking parlor of that dairy barn, of that dairy farm. It was a relatively large dairy farm, and they sold out to build a golf course there, which is now owned by the casino. So there is a connection to the casino in agriculture, even though you maybe didn't know that when you brought it up.
Well, I didn't know that, but sometimes you're just lucky. But I bring it up because I've got a former neighbor that wants to meet me at the casino there. So
okay, well, spend lots of money while you're there. We need it.
It's okay?
That would be okay.
Okay.
I give you permission if that's what you're looking for.
Representative Fritz.
Well, thank you, Manager. Is Toby's in your area?
Yes, Toby's is the first thing you see when you get off the highway in Hinckley. Yeah.
And I thought that was a state law. You had to stop at Toby's on the way. That's my law.
Yeah, they're famous for the Commeroles. And some of you remember Bud Hygerkin. He and Toby's used to have a battle as to who had the best Commeroles in the state every year.
Really?
And he said, one year I beat him, but only one time, and then the next year they beat me again. So
that
was an ongoing rivalry between he and Toby's.
Thank you, Representative Faust. I think Representative Anderson did have a question during the presentation. Just what are the worms?
He sells them to... Yeah, he sells them to a wholesaler who sells them for use as bait, you know, they use them for.
Okay. All right, very good. Well, thank you for the presentation. We appreciate it, and I think we have no further questions, no further bills or anything today, so meeting adjourned.